Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome National Economic Council Director Gene Sperling.
Thank you so much. Let me thank, first of all, our earlier speakers, Danielle Gray, our Cabinet Affairs, who's also been a champion for labor and wage issues. Seth Harris, as you can see, has championed not only the issue of the minimum wage, but issues of fighting for Americans, workers. He may be acting Secretary of Labor, but he's not acting. He's doing the real thing every day. And Alan Krueger, who, as you know, has been our chairman of the Council of Economic Advisors. You've heard about his role. He will be going back to academia, but for a generation of policymakers, Alan has been the go-to person on everything from the minimum wage to the importance of summer learning for low-income kids. So he'll be having a huge impact wherever he is on public policy, and of course, no one has probably done more for the minimum wage. I want to thank SEIU and NELP and AFL-CIO and so many others who helped put this together. All the workers behind me, the four who spoke, Patty, Edgar, Arisimo, William, I just want to say, and I mean this from the bottom of my heart, I was already with you. I was already for the minimum wage increase. I was already there. But hearing you talk, it just so inspires me to just go back and ask how we can work a little harder, push a little harder, and get this done. So if you have had no other impact, you have impacted me. You've already heard a lot, and you've got a better speaker coming after me. I'll just make a couple of points real quick. You know, one, we're not asking for a lot more. The president and the vice president are not asking for a lot more than just ensuring we do not devalue the basic compact and contract that Franklin Delano Roosevelt started. And when I say devalue, I mean that in kind of monetary terms. You know, you can ask, say that what we're doing is just trying to ensure that the minimum wage is still worth what it was in 1938. When it first passed. It has not done a good job so far. It has increased 22 times. But from 78 to 89, the minimum wage real value declined by 34%. From 1998 to 2006, its real value declined by 19%. So even when Congress has acted, even we've acted, and I've been proud to be a part of that, we still have not got the minimum wage where it needs to go. And what President Obama and Vice President Biden have put forward, as have Senator Harkin and Congressman Miller put forward, is to just make sure we can at least say the following, that the minimum wage will at least be worth what it was in 1981, 30-some years ago. That's not asking a lot, but it would mean so much to the workers standing behind me and the millions and millions more around this country. As I said, there's a lot of public policies you do where you wonder, well, what would it mean? How would it happen? How would it get implemented? What's the time schedule? That's not true at the minimum wage. It gives people a raise. It gives people 4,000 dollars more in their pocket to help support their families. Number two, second point I want to make is that you should care about all workers. But if you have a particular passion for worrying about women in the workforce, you should definitely care about increasing the minimum wage. 60% of minimum wage workers are women. And when we talk about the importance of raising the tip minimum wage, which is currently at $2.13 and hasn't changed in over 20 years, now the lowest share of the regular minimum wage on record, just remember, that's two-thirds of those workers are women, and of the servers, which make up the largest amount, 71% are women. So minimum wage is a workers' issue. It is also a working women's issue. Third point I make is just Alan walked through the research and the history and his own amazing path-breaking study on minimum wage and employment, but I won't repeat it. But the studies that have followed in his path have also shown how it reduces the churn of workers, that it actually increases, there's a Chicago Fed study that shows it increases the purchasing power, because as one of the panelists said, it's in my pocket, I will spend it. And so it increases the purchasing power in our economy. As Alan, or the real economist might say, it goes to people who have a very high propensity to consume. And it even has positive health impacts. And the fourth point I just make is that this is not a policy we look at alone. What inspires the president and the vice president is a very core value. If you work hard, if you work full time, you should not have to raise your children or live in poverty. You should be able to live and work with dignity. And when we look at that, we look at the minimum wage, but we also look at the earned income tax credit. We look at the child tax credit, the other things that come together, the Affordable Care Act, and make a difference. So when we were sitting there with the vice president and the president at midnight trying to solve the fiscal deal so we didn't go over the cliff, the attention was all on, would we extend the tax cuts for the 100 million plus middle-class workers, but till that last moment, the vice president and president fought to make sure we extended the earned income tax credit and the refundable tax credit that goes to the workers who are working hardest, often increasing the minimum wage and making sure there's another $1,000, $2,000 in their pocket so that they, again, will not have to live in poverty but can live with dignity. Yes. And that leads me to my great privilege to introduce the Vice President of the United States. So I'm just going to say four quick points about him. Number one, I got to out him. He is going to come out here and tell you he's just not really a policy wonk. Not true. I'm sorry, Mr. Vice President, after the hours we have spent in the budget, that guy can go toe-to-toe on economic analysis and budget points with anybody in the United States of America, so I apologize, but I am outing him. He is a fellow budget and economic wonk, whether he wants to identify himself that way or not, number one. Number two, today was a day that we did see a little bit of signs of our recovery healing. We saw consumer confidence, the best since January of 08. We saw housing prices rising the highest since 2006. And it's worth remembering that when the president came in, and we were averaging, and this is hard to remember or stomach, but the economy was contracting at 7.8%, contracting at 7.8% over a six-month period, and we're losing 800,000 jobs a month, 800,000 jobs a month. And the person the president asked to be his economic warrior to get the American Recovery Act in place in this dark, dark period when we could have gone into a second Great Depression was the vice president. And he, not only in the passage, but in the implementation, the most difficult measures, there was no detail, too small, there was no place he would not visit. And I think when the story is told of this economic recovery, there will be the ample share of credit that rightly goes to the leadership of Joe Biden. And he will be the first to say, we have a long, long way to go. We're not nearly satisfied, but the fact we've come this far is in no small part due to, of course, President Obama, but also to the leadership he took on the American Recovery Act. My last two things I'll say are a little more personal. When I got to write my one and only book, I tried to write in that I thought that one of the values that animated our country was the sense that every American, that the goal of our economic policy should be that every American can raise their children with dignity, work with dignity, and retire with dignity. If you asked me who was the one political leader of our times who more speaks about dignity from the heart for longer and with more passion and more authenticity than anyone, I would pick Joe Biden. It is what he raises at the table with the president. It's what he talks about in speeches. And related to that, and I thought about him when we asked, you know, what would that extra few thousand dollars mean to people, and I think the four of you basically responded, a little peace of mind, a little dignity, a little ability to better support our children and your family. That's what animates the vice president. Last thing I'll say is, you know, it's interesting in Washington, D.C., when you walk somebody walk into a room. A lot of people walk into the room and they look, well, who's the most important person? Who's a potential political supporter? Who's a potential financial supporter? Where are the reporters? When Joe Biden walks into a room, he sees the people who set up the room. He sees the people who will clean up the room. He sees all of the people who are working hard, and he treats everyone with the same level of dignity he would if he was walking into a room to meet a head of state. And I imagine for his scheduling team, this is not always a great thing. But I have to say, it's just what endears me, what endears him to me and so much is his heart and the what when he sees a room that he sees everybody who works and is part of that room and treats them with equal dignity. And with that, I am so proud to introduce our great, great Vice President, Joe Biden.
Thank you very, very much. Thank you. The reason Gene said that all about me is I've been taking advice from him for 20 years, and I've learned a great deal from him. But we do share something in common, I think, with all the folks behind me, and I suspect most of you, that at the end of the day, you know, my dad used to have an expression. He said, Joey, a job's about a lot more than a paycheck, having lost a job and having moved from one city to another. He'd always say, it's about a lot more than your paycheck. It's about your dignity. That was his phrase, about your dignity. It's about your sense of yourself. It's about your self-respect. People behind me, they have an incredible amount of self-respect. And they deserve to be paid in a way that reflects the dignity that they exude. Folks, it's great to be here with Acting Secretary Seth Harris. As Gene said, Seth is not acting, man. He is doing one heck of a job, and I've enjoyed traveling around the country with him. He's first rate. He cares a lot, and I'm going to really miss Alan Krueger. Alan is sort of the class of the field. I know he's going back to Princeton, and it's lucky for them, but we're going to miss him, but he also knows that he's not going to get away. It's only a telephone call. Folks, before I start, I have to say that, like so many across the country, I'm disappointed in the Supreme Court's decision today, you may or may not have heard of, in Shelby County versus Holder, the Voting Rights Act. The Voting Rights Act, the cornerstone of the American Civil Rights Movement, the thing that really got me engaged in politics as a young kid, got me to run for the United States Senate when I was 29 years old. That law, today's decision, upset a well-established practice. The Voting Rights Act has been repeatedly enacted by overwhelming bipartisan majorities in the Congress. For 17 years, I was chairman of or the ranking member of the Judiciary Committee. And every time it came up for reauthorization, we got support. If I'm not mistaken, the last time, Strom Thurmond voted to reauthorize it as well. No, I'm serious. So in 2006, it was reauthorized by unanimous support of the United States Senate and near unanimous support of the House of Representatives. And this support is based on a recognition that voting is a fundamental right. It's the foundation of our democracy. The Voting Rights Act has been critical and an effective means to guarantee that core right. As the Supreme Court acknowledged, we've made progress as a nation. The Supreme Court also recognized voting discrimination still exists. Between 1982 and 2006, the Justice Department blocked 700 changes in local voting rules, 700 changes. Based on their determination that the changes were designed to be discriminatory. They discriminated. In 2011, South Carolina passed a law requiring voters to show certain forms of ID at the polls. The Justice Department objected to the law. At the trial, showing that there were 60,000 black voters in the state who would have been denied the right to vote the day the law took effect. But folks, as we move forward, let's remember that that not all of the Voting Rights Act was struck down. The court, I won't go into the detail of the decision, but the Congress, it says the Congress can pass new legislation. They struck down a section that talked about new regulations ensuring that every American has equal access to the polls. We're going to work with Congress in this effort, and the administration can do everything in our power to ensure fair and equal voting processes are maintained. So there's a lot of work that's going to have to be done, but it's nonetheless disappointing that the court made the change, made the decision it did. Now I want to move on to the reason why we're all here, and I apologize for everyone for moving to that first, but I want you to picture, and I know that that Alan and Gene have spoken to you already, but I want you to picture an American kitchen table in the 1930s. I think of my Grandpa Finnegan's table in Scranton, Pennsylvania, for real. Five kids, 1930. Go back and look at your grandparents. And think of when they sat around the table, some of you with backgrounds not dissimilar to mine. There's several children sitting in exhausted silence, the light of childhood dimmed in their eyes from the long hours and dangerous work. They're working in a factory or in a slag heap in Scranton. My family did not. There's a chair sitting empty because one of the parents is still at work, putting in a 16-hour day. And even though everyone in the family is working, there's not enough food around to go around to fill that table, fill people's stomachs. But there is hope. There was hope. On the mantle, there is a picture of President Franklin Roosevelt, who promised that he would do something to eliminate, in his words, child labor and long hours and starvation wages. That was his quote. So 1938, with the first female secretary in a cabinet, Frances Perkins, the Department of Labor, they acted. The Fair Labor Standard Act was passed. It outlawed oppressive child labor. It set a 40-hour work week. And it set a minimum wage of 25 cents per hour. Now, at the time, many said this would lead to job losses, and it was downright un-American. Seriously, listen to the rhetoric and see if it sounds familiar to you. In 1938, Senator Arthur Vandenberg said that this was what he called a fascist bill. As he said, we are driven closer and ever closer to centralized authoritarianism. A centralized authoritarian state with its tyranny of oppressive government-blessed monopolies, end of quote. 7 decades later, we're still hearing the same kind of arguments. In 2007, Congressman Jeb Hensarlinger said, and I quote, we can have either maximum opportunity or we can have minimum wages. We cannot have both. You know, it really doesn't matter that the GDP has grown 600% since that law was enacted. Every time we update the law, particularly minimum wage, we're told it will be the death of the American economy. In 1955, Barry Goldwater said the rise of the minimum wage would mean, and I quote, economic chaos for the very people we're trying to help. That's always the great argument. You all are going to be hurt by what we're going to do. That's sort of the key. In 80, when he said he was running for president, Ronald Reagan said the minimum wage has caused more misery and unemployment than anything since the Great Depression. In 1996, after Democrats voted to increase the minimum wage, Congressman Jack Kingston said, today the Democrats say goodbye to 500,000 jobs. By the way, that year after the wage increase went into effect, the economy added 3.4 million new jobs. Look, the fact is that numerous studies using methods like comparing experiences in counties right across the line, one county in one state, another county in another state, when one state raised the minimum wage and the other did not, they've shown that increasing the minimum wage has no negative impact on employment, none. Instead, it increases employers' ability to attract, retain, and motivate workers. And it benefits workers by increasing the reward to work. Businesses like Costco and StrideRight have supported past increases of the minimum wage because it's helped build strong and stable workforces and profitability over the long run. The opponents were wrong about the future in 1938, and they are wrong now in 2013. And so we're here today to celebrate the 75th anniversary of one of the greatest laws to ever come out of this country, in my view. But 75 years later, Republicans in the House seem to think that overtime is a luxury and is not mandated by the minimum wage, by the Fair Labor Standards Act, and that you can raise a family on today's minimum wage. $7.25 an hour. These people work hard. $7.25 an hour. $14,500 a year for a 40-hour week. It's not enough to make in today's world. It's not even enough to make it above the poverty level. Folks, it's time to raise the minimum wage and keep faith with the Fair Labor Standards Act. In his State of the Union message, the president asked for an increase in the minimum wage and to have it indexed to inflation. So don't keep having this fight over and over and over again. We're also talking about raising the minimum wage for tipped workers, as was mentioned. Many people don't realize that servers in restaurants are subject to lower minimum wage because they get tips. There's a logic to that. But the rate hasn't been increased for over 20 years. We're going to fix that. These proposed increases would raise wages for over 15 million people. Think of the impact that will have on the economy, on their economy, our economy. Put a little extra money in the hands of so many consumers. Think about what it means to a middle-class family. An increase would cover all that they are now spending on groceries. Just this increase. If we increase the minimum wage, which is just what we're talking about, all the money you spend on a year on groceries will be equal to that increase. It's like getting a free year of groceries. The same thing goes for all the gasoline you spend for 1 year, or 6 months of your housing cost. That's what it's like. That's what it means in terms of an average family on minimum wage. And raising minimum wage doesn't just benefit the workers behind me. It creates a proven ripple effect that increases wages all the way up to scale. The 2011 study that was referred to by Gene of the Federal Reserve Bank in Chicago found that a $1 increase in minimum wage increases household spending in the following year by about $2,800, which stimulates economic growth in local communities. Some of the nation's leading economists beyond Gene and Allen, Lauren Katz, Richard Freeman, Joseph Stiglitz, Laura Tyson, argued that, quote, low-wage workers spend their additional earnings, potentially raising demand and job growth. Therefore, pursuing higher minimum wage at this juncture will not only provide raises for low-wage workers, but provide some help that we need for the job front on the job front as well. Folks, it's not like these are spendthrifts. It's not like, you know, when you say, well, these guys will go out and spend the raise. They'll spend the raise to try to make sure they got enough food on the table. They'll spend the raise to make sure that they can keep the heat up during the winter. They'll spend the raise to make sure that they can make it. They'd like to be able to save it, but they have to spend it to make it. But the effect is that ripples all through the economy. It doesn't just benefit them. This ripple effect, once a higher wage floor is set, workers higher up the chain are in a better position also to see their wages raised. And minimum wage workers are not able to keep up. The value of the federal minimum wage, which was already mentioned here, has decreased by 30% since 1968. In other words, all they're asking here is for just pay me minimum wage with what you paid folks in 1968. Think of those terms. They're not asking a whole heck of a lot. In 1980 alone, increases in inflation eroded the 81 level by 27% by 1989. Jargon always used by a Republican president, only workers making the minimum wage are teenagers. How many times you hear the teenager? I used to, in the Senate, always hear this argument. Well, you know, they're just stocking shelves, these teenagers, and you're going to put the local hardware store out of business. And guess what he's going to do? He's not going to hire teenage workers, he or she. They're going to let them go, and so there'll be less employment. It's always here. Well, let's get the facts straight. 20%, only 20% of the people making the minimum wage are teenagers. The rest are hardworking adults, many of them with families, and I mean hardworking. Talk to a janitor who has to pay for his own uniform while earning the bare minimum wage with backbreaking work. Talk to the hardworking people who get behind me, gather here today. One other fact, about 60%, as was pointed out by Gene, because we both have a passion related to this, are making the minimum wage are women, a lot of them with children. It's about time we stop treating work in fields where women are the majority as less valuable than in male-dominated fields. Look, I have two brothers and a sister. I had the great pleasure of my mom living with me in her final years. Toward the end, my mom needed help. She broke her hip. And I'm down here, and my mom was too proud to move down here. She didn't want to move to the vice president's house. But she stayed home in my house. And so we were there all the time. My sister, God love her, my mom used to have an expression. It says, a son's a son till he gets a wife, a daughter's a daughter the rest of her life. Well, my sister is my closest friend, and my brother Jim, who lived in Philly, they were there all the time with mom. And then I'd be home every weekend. I got a lot of criticism. Why'd Biden go home so much in the first 3 years? Well, I went home because my mom was home. Simple proposition. And I'm not that far away. And but it turned out after she broke her hip, she needed some help. She didn't need a nurse, an RN, or even a practical nurse. She needed just somebody to sometimes help her get up in her walker, maybe unload the washing machine. My mother insisted on doing her wash, but when it's heavy, to put it out of the washer into the dryer, she needed a little bit of help. Didn't want to help, but she knew she needed it. And just make sure that there was some help making her meals. Well, let me tell you something. We went out and got great people. They were wonderful, and my mom. With one exception, they're all women. And fortunately, my brothers and sister have done better than I have. And we were able to all chip in and make sure everything was paid. But it was very expensive. Those of you who are doing the same thing with your families, you know that. Well, you know, the take-home the care of workers, for example, there are nearly 1.8 million home care workers across the country, hardworking and pretty professional, mostly women, who work around the clock so folks like my mom get help bathing, cooking, keeping track of their medications, which is a chore by itself, live independently in their own homes, or, in this case, with me not there. Think of all those baby boomers trying to care for their parents, seeking care for themselves. So one of the fastest growing industries is a good thing in America is home care. But here's the thing. As the home care business has changed over the years, the law hasn't changed to keep up. In some cases, folks work for large companies that provide these workers. They charge a reasonable price, which is a lot of money, but then turn around and pay less than the minimum wage. Not the outfit I had, best of my knowledge, but they turn around and pay less than a minimum wage for providing service. So this exception that was built in the law 75 years ago, when you go to the next door neighbor and they're helping you out kind of thing, that's not where we are today. So in December 2011, the president made a commitment to guarantee home care workers hired by third-party employers a minimum wage and overtime pay protection. Now we're following through on that promise. Look, the president and I and all the guys and women you met in our team so far, this administration, is now working to finalize the rule that will get this done. Look, it's an example of the basic question of economic growth and fairness. Shouldn't someone working 40 hours a week be able to make a wage that's above the poverty level? I mean, it's not about dignity, it's about decency. I mean, working 40 hours a week. It's just that simple. American workers built this country. The folks behind me and those who went before them built this country. And so we got to continue to support them. The Fair Labor Standard Act is as relevant today as it was the day it was passed. And this is worth the fight. And looking out at all of you, I'm confident we have the better side of the argument and the better side of the army on our side. And so, folks, we are determined. It's wages, it's overtime, and it is decency, and it's about, at the end of the day, as Gene said, and his book does focus on, the whole notion of dignity. Just simple dignity. No man or woman who works 40 hours a week should go home and look at their kids and say, honey, we got to apply for food stamps. We got to apply for this particular help or that particular help. No one wants to have to do that. Nobody wants to do that. I'm going to make it on their own. And folks, that's all this is about, a fighting chance. So God bless you all, and may God protect our troops. Thank you so much.